Setlist in association with 7 Digital.
This week, Fortnite goes to battle with Apple. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
As ever, we are going to be taking a look back at some of the biggest and most interesting music industry news stories of the last week. A week when Beats One became Apple Music One and was joined by two new stations on the Apple streaming service.
Beats One, of course, being the global radio station that Apple set up when it launched the Apple Music streaming service 5 years ago, called Beats, because of course Apple also owned the Beats headphone brand. And when they bought the Beats company, it had a streaming service called Beats Music. And there was lots of speculation that when Apple finally got round to, you know, giving up on iTunes, I mean, not completely, but mainly, and setting up a streaming service, some people thought, well, will they just call it Beats Music? They've bought it. It already exists. Maybe the Apple streaming service will be Beats Music. But it wasn't, of course. It was Apple Music. But they kept the Beats bit for the little radio station that sits on the side that nobody listens to. But to be fair, it does get quite a lot of shout-outs on social and quite a few, like, you know, big-name American artists do shows, don't they? So I'm not sure anyone listens to it, but it is a good hype machine for Apple Music. And now it will be branded as such to be known as Apple Music One.
Yes, which I mean is possibly slightly confusing because, I mean, I can see why they went with Beats One initially, because Apple Music One sounds like, I mean, it's, the streaming service is called Apple Music. So Apple Music One, well, I guess it's the radio station of the streaming service. Maybe it does make sense. It seems confusing. The other thing that's confusing is that although they've rebranded it Apple Music One and they've launched two new stations, neither of those stations is called Apple Music Two.
Yeah, I mean, all the way back in 2015, when they launched the service and it was called Beats One, there was lots of speculation that, oh, well, that must mean that there's going to be a second and a third and a fourth, and there'll be Beats Two and Beats Three and Beats Four. That didn't then happen for 5 years, but it has now happened. But yeah, the two new global online radio stations that will sit alongside the Apple Music streaming service are Apple Music Hits, playing all the hits from the 80s, 90s and the 2000s, and then Apple Music Country, which I didn't double check, but I assume that's a country music station. Yeah, so neither of those are called Apple Music 2. That offends you, doesn't it? That we have a number one, and then we have two more services, but those are not 2 and 3.
Well, if you're not going to number them, and you're rebranding your one station, why not rebrand Beats 1 as something else more descriptive?
It is quite common in radio land, where you have companies that operate, say, 2 or 3 radio stations, sister stations in an area, it isn't that uncommon for one of them to be called number one and then there not to be a number two. Although that usually happens because at some point there was. So there was a period in the UK for certain where quite a lot of radio companies would have one was their FM station and two was their AM station. And they would have the same brand and they'd operate in the same area. But then invariably at some point they would then rebrand the AM station as something else. And then you do end up with a one, with no 2, 3 or 4. But Apple haven't even done that. They've deliberately chosen to have a second station, not called Apple Music 2. But, you know, I suspect that nobody listening to this podcast has ever listened to Beats 1 or will ever listen to any of these Apple radio stations. So to an extent, I suppose it doesn't really matter.
Now, I suppose Apple Music series of vanity project shows is a bit wordy, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't think that would work as a brand. However honest that might be, it wouldn't work as a brand. But anyway, that's not what we're here to talk about this week.
No, because later we will be discussing two copyright cases which weren't copyright cases that failed because they were copyright cases. But first, Fortnite maker Epic Games last week ramped up its legal efforts against Apple after recently going public with a dispute over the tech giant's App Store rules.
Yes, and if you're thinking, hey, hang on a second, I've tuned in to the Music Business podcast from CMU, they seem to be talking about a big development in the gaming industry. And you would be right.
It does seem a bit like that. Yeah.
That is what we're doing. But hey, we do have a link to the music industry, which we will get to eventually. So stick with us. Those of you who hate gaming and everything to do with gaming, but love music business news, because there is a music business angle to this. But yes, this is the big beef between Fortnite makers Epic Games and Apple, as you say. And it all began just over a week ago, as this podcast goes out, with the latest update to the Fortnite app on both iOS and Android devices. And what Epic Games did in that update is they added ways to make in-app payments through Fortnite that circumvented the Apple and Google payment platforms. And as we've discussed before on Setlist, that's a big no-no. If you have an app on an iOS device, on an Apple device, and you are taking payments through that app, whether those are one-off payments, pay-as-you-go payments, subscription payments, if you're taking the payments through your iOS app, you have to use Apple's payment system. And then a similar rule if on Android with Google's payment system. And the reason why Apple and Google like that is because whenever money goes through their payment systems, they get to charge a 15 to 30% commission on the money that's going through. So that's why Apple and Google like that rule. It's why everybody else who makes apps that goes on these devices hate that rule. And then there are some additional rules which say not only can you not allow people to make payments through your apps using payment platforms other than the Apple platform on iOS and the Google platform on Android, not only can you not circumvent those systems, there are also rules about how you communicate that fact. And Apple's rules are slightly stricter than Google's rules. But for example, under the law of Apple, you can't say within the app, "Hey, user, if we take payment from you here, we're going to have to give 30% to Apple. But you know, if you go to our website and make a payment with us there, we won't have to give Apple any money and everyone will be happy." You can't do that. So you can't circumvent the payment systems, and then you can't put language in the app or functionality or instructions in the app that encourages people to go make payments elsewhere. But Epic, ever the rule breaker, ignored that fact, put this upgrade to that app out there, knowing that in doing so, their app would be kicked out of the Apple App Store and the Android App Store. That was totally the plan, because as soon as Apple had confirmed that they were kicking Fortnite out of the App Store because Epic had broken the rules, and then subsequently Google did the same, well, two things happened. First of all, litigation happened, and secondly, a big PR campaign was launched.
Yes, so first there was legal action against Apple and Google, accusing them of anti-competitive behaviour over these payment systems. And there was also an advert which specifically went for Apple, and it was a spoof of Apple's famous 1984 commercial, which was kind of saying 1984 wasn't going to be like George Orwell's book because Apple was here to make everything nice now. Something along those lines. And then obviously Fortnite's version is saying that no, Apple is Big Brother, and it's gone against everything it said it would be, and Fortnite's great. And look at this animated version of an old advert that you probably haven't seen that we've made.
Yeah, so very much a two-pronged attack by Epic, which we assume have been a long time in the making. So quite sneaky, really, that they knew that when they made these changes to the app, almost immediately Apple and Google would respond, and they were sitting there ready with the litigation over here and the PR campaign over here. We're actually going to talk a little bit more about the litigation, not the initial lawsuit. Within days, a second lawsuit had been filed against Apple. But before we get into that, I mean, I suppose, yeah, I mean, the PR angle here is quite interesting. Obviously, Fortnite, massive phenomenon around the world, a big user base, a lot of young users. And clearly the point of this advert and the way they're pushing it out, even within the game, is to get their user base, including their young user base, sort of angry with Apple and the big bag tech companies, so that they have public support over here while they're pursuing litigation over here. Some have questioned whether or not that's a good thing, particularly with the younger users and sort of trying to, well, I don't know, there's that whole thing, isn't
there? Weaponize children?
Well, exactly. And will those people, the passionate Fortnite users who possibly don't understand all the arguments, now start sending threatening tweets and messages and emails to people at Apple and Google and whatever? Although I did wonder whether or not the team at Epic Games were slightly inspired by what Google did with the what we then called Article 13 debate as part of the European Copyright Directive. Because you remember those few months where 12-year-old YouTube fans were all shouting about this quite complicated bit of copyright law reform.
Yeah.
And Google, having initially done everything behind the scenes, then really tried to get its young user base to sort of be writing to their MEPs and shouting about the copyright reform that people like the music industry wanted, etc., etc. And it's a sort of a similar thing. I mean, that said, I mean, ultimately, Google didn't succeed, did they? Because Article 13, as it was then, became Article 17, did end up in the final version of the directive. Possibly not quite as strongly worded as the music industry would have liked, but most people agreed that Google lost that battle. So I don't know whether or not they were inspired by that, but it is interesting seeing another company with a big, passionate, loyal user base, with a lot of young users, trying to energize that audience to help them with, in this case, a slightly tedious competition law dispute over here. So remains to be seen whether or not that PR side to this A works, and B whether it has any slightly negative side effects, unintended consequences perhaps. But in addition to that, as I said, there are actually two legal filings from Epic Games against Apple in the last 10 days. The first one accusing Apple of anti-competitive conduct because of its payment systems and the rules around its payment systems, and then pretty much the same arguments presented against Google. But then a few days later, there was the second legal filing from Epic Games, which basically is trying to get the judges to stop Apple from cutting Epic Games off while this dispute is going through the motions. So we had the first lawsuit all about Apple's alleged anti-competitive conduct, and then the second lawsuit saying Apple have already taken sanctions against us because of this, and they shouldn't be allowed to do that while this legal battle is ongoing.
And in terms of what those sanctions are, I mean, predictably, Apple has removed Fortnite from its App Store, but there are other things on top of that as well. So Apple has also threatened to cut off Epic's access to the development tools that are required to create software for use on Apple platforms, which would not only affect Fortnite, but all of Epic's games and other products, including this thing called the Unreal Engine, which is a platform that other developers use. And so that goes beyond Epic itself. In its lawsuit, Epic claimed that millions of third-party developers use the Unreal Engine. So it's at least claiming that this has a very broad potential knock-on effect.
And basically what Epic Games was saying in its second legal filing is these are severe sanctions that Apple is imposing. And if it's planning on imposing them for as long as this dispute runs, assuming Epic Games don't back down and reissue a version of the Fortnite app without the alternative payment options. But if those sanctions are in place for as long as it takes for this legal dispute to go through the courts, well, we all know legal disputes take quite a long time to go through the courts. And so basically what Epic Games were saying was, we're confident we're going to win this dispute, but we would be hugely damaged if Apple imposes these sanctions for as long as it takes us to win that lawsuit. And so therefore what they want is a judge to issue an injunction saying Apple is not allowed to instigate any of these sanctions. And I think Epic are looking for an injunction covering all of them, although maybe a compromise would be, well, okay, you're allowed to kick Fortnite out of the App Store, but these other sanctions you have to hold off. I don't know. But anyway, they want the injunction so that while this dispute goes through the motions, they still have access to all of the things within the Apple platform, as would the Unreal Engine, etc., etc. So that's what they were asking for. And it was a pretty bombastic legal filing, making some pretty damning statements about Apple.
Yeah, it began by citing the recent hearing in US Congress considering the dominance of the big tech and internet companies in America, at which Apple CEO Tim Cook gave evidence. It said that during that, Cook was asked whether Apple has ever retaliated against or disadvantaged a developer who went public about their frustrations with the App Store. Mr. Cook testified, "We do not retaliate or bully people. It's strongly against our company culture. But," Epic Games says, "Apple has just done that." It goes on, "Not content simply to remove Fortnite from the App Store, Apple is attacking Epic's entire business in unrelated areas. Epic is likely to succeed on the merits of its claims, but without an injunction, Epic would be irreparably harmed long before the final judgment comes. Technology markets move swiftly," it goes on. "Left unchecked, Apple's actions will irreparably damage Epic's reputation among Fortnite users and be catastrophic for the future of the separate Unreal Engine business."
So some tough talking there by Epic Games in both that second legal filing they made last week, and indeed, for that matter, in the original legal filing that was made a few days before that. It remains to be seen how this whole dispute now progresses, but we promised you a music business angle to to this gaming industry story. And that is, of course, well, one company that will be following this Epic Games versus Apple dispute very closely and relishing it all will be Spotify, because Spotify also hates the fact that if you do in-app purchases on an iOS device, Apple gets to grab 15 to 30% of the money and you can't put easy access to alternative payment options in your apps because of Apple's rules. And we know that because, as we've almost certainly talked about on Setlist before, Spotify also launched a consumer-facing campaign on this issue, not quite to the extent that Epic Games and Fortnite have, but Spotify hasn't sued Apple, but it basically went to the European Commission saying that it thinks that what Apple does, and Spotify is specifically going after Apple, whereas Epic have a similar beef with Google, but Spotify has basically said to competition regulators in Europe, we think this breaches European competition law, we think you should investigate. The European Commission is now investigating, and the point at which Spotify went to the EC to ask for that investigation, they also launched a consumer-facing website in which they explain why they think what Apple's doing is unfair, anti-competitive, it's bad for the consumer, they would argue. So Spotify beat Epic Games by a year, possibly more, in terms of taking this dispute public, although not quite to the level, as I say, that Epic Games have. But that means that, first of all, Spotify will be pleased that Epic has gone so big on this and is fighting it under American law, whereas Spotify is pursuing its case under European law. It will be happy that all the Fortnite users will be getting angry about this. Obviously, as far as Spotify is concerned, what they would like to see is a result of all of this. Apple, either because of regulator pressure or through losing a lawsuit, will be forced to make some changes, or maybe even just that the public pressure that will come from what Epic Games is doing might persuade Apple to relax some of those rules in some way. So Spotify will be following this very closely, as indeed will be plenty of other music services that have Apple iOS apps and who either do take payments through their iOS apps or would like to take payments through their iOS apps but can't at the moment because of Apple's rules and they can't afford to give up 30%. Because, I mean, music companies, digital music companies, I suppose I should say, were beefing about this, I mean, when Steve Jobs was still alive. So, I mean, that's a long time ago now. So this isn't a new issue by any means, but it is an issue that Spotify went big on last year and which Epic Games and Fortnite are going on big now. So, although not technically a music story, a story the outcome of which could have a big impact on the business models of companies like Spotify and therefore the music industry.
So earlier on in this episode, I promised you two copyright lawsuits that were not copyright lawsuits, but failed because they were actually copyright lawsuits. And we always deliver on our promises here at Setlist. So we'll kick off with 50 Cent, who has had his latest attempt to sue over an uncleared sample on a Rick Ross mixtape knocked back by an appeals court, which does sound like a copyright lawsuit to me.
But it wasn't. But it probably should have been. That's the point. So yes, obviously, 50 Cent and Rick Ross have had a very long-running feud that has manifested itself in an assortment of ways. But one way in which it manifested itself was back in 2015, Rick Ross had a new album out. The album was called Black Market. He chose to promote that album with a mixtape, as rappers and people in hip-hop sometimes do. And in the mixtape, one of the many, many tracks that he sampled was a little snippet of 50 Cent's big hit, In Da Club. He then rapped on top of it. And I guess because 50 Cent and Rick Ross have this very long-running feud, 50 Cent was pissed off that his rival had used a snippet of his track in his promotional mixtape. And so he wanted to, try and do something about it.
Now, of course, promotional mixtapes are very common in hip-hop, as you just said. And they quite frequently, I mean, I would say in almost all cases, feature unclear tracks and samples in that mix. And the music industry usually turns a blind eye to it because most of the rappers and labels who could sue have probably used mixtapes full of uncleared music to promote their own releases in the past. And I mean, it's just part of, I think we've discussed on Setlist before, it's part of the culture and it's how people come up in hip-hop. So if you start suing over mixtapes, you kind of get rid of a whole avenue for people to get into hip-hop and become the next big thing, become the new 50 Cent and Rick Ross's. So, yeah, it's a sort of, it's a thing that is allowed to happen. Nevertheless, this mixtape called Renzel Remixes did include an uncleared sample of In the Club, meaning that there would have been grounds for a copyright infringement claim. And had one been made, Rick Ross would almost as certainly have said it was fair use and he was protected by his First Amendment's free speech rights. And then the court would have had to have a debate about whether those defences are credible, which would have been interesting. But none of that happened because although 50% was pissed off about having his track sampled without permission, he didn't own the copyright in that track. Actually, it was owned by two Universal Interscope imprints, Shady Records and Aftermath. And Universal could, of course, have launched that legal action on his behalf. But this might have been a factor in why they didn't. The mixtape that Rick Ross had put out was promoting an album released by Universal imprint Def Jam Records. So therefore, the whole copyright infringement angle is off limits to 50 Cent. And he had to find a different angle. Therefore, he sued on the basis that his right to publicity had been infringed, specifically his publicity rights under the state laws of Connecticut, which is where he filed his lawsuit. And publicity or image rights are separate to copyright and can be enforced under various state laws in the US.
Yes, so that's what kind of made this a copyright case that wasn't a copyright case. Because as you say, even if 50 Cent had been willing to break with the unwritten rule in the music industry, certainly the hip-hop industry, which is that you don't sue over other people's mixtapes because that would make you a hypocrite. Even if he'd been willing to do this, he couldn't sue on copyright grounds because he wasn't the copyright owner. Hence, he pursued a publicity rights case. Publicity rights, as you say, being something that exists in state law in various places in the US, different to copyright. In response to that lawsuit, Rick Ross's lawyers had two arguments. First of all, there was a slight complication in that they said he didn't even have the publicity rights, and that was to do with the record deal that he had done with Interscope and its Shady Records and Aftermath divisions. And I think that was basically in the record contract that he had signed with the label. He gave the label the rights to exploit his publicity rights for the purposes of promoting music. So they were basically saying, actually, those publicity rights now belong to Interscope, not to 50 Cent. So again, Interscope could sue, but 50 Cent can't, was one of the arguments that Rick Ross's teams presented. But maybe more importantly than that was the idea that, do you know what? This is a copyright case. And he's pursuing a publicity rights case because he's not the copyright owner. And that's kind of playing the system. And the argument was that copyright law, which is federal law in the US, should gazump state laws like publicity rights. Because I guess if you're saying that 50 Cent has a case here, then you're basically saying that even if Interscope had licensed the sample, so the copyright was fine, there's still a case to answer under publicity rights. And if that's allowed to happen, well, that really weakens the hand of the copyright owner. It basically screws with the copyright. And it just makes the whole copyright licensing system a nightmare. So, in essence, they're saying, in order for our federal copyright law to work, we can't allow these state laws around publicity rights to interfere. Was the argument that was presented by the Rick Ross side when this originally got to court a few years ago. Initially, the district court accepted those arguments and sided with Rick Ross. 50 Cent then appealed, and that's what the ruling last week was about. It was basically the Second Circuit Appeals Court in the US. Also considering this case, it has to be said in the main, they also sided with Rick Ross.
So the appeal court didn't exactly uphold the original ruling on the first point, whether or not 50 Cent was even able to enforce his publicity rights in this case due to his contract with Interscope. Well, they said that they thought that that had all ended in 2014, although no one seemed exactly sure whether that was the case or not. It was to do with that clause only being in force while the deal was active. And 50 Cent said the deal had not been active since 2014. And Rick Ross's side didn't dispute that. So they basically said, well, he was able to sue on the grounds of his publicity rights being enforced because they were his rights. But on the second point, importantly, it did uphold that original claim, and therefore 50 Cent's case is gone.
Yeah, federal copyright law gazumps state rights to publicity. So even if he had those publicity rights, which they think he probably did, he can't enforce them in this case. And in essence, what they were saying was, because this is ultimately a copyright case, and you're not the copyright owner. You can't have a copyright case without a copyright owner. So unfortunately, I mean, I don't know whether 50 Cent will now give up or whether he'll try and pursue this even further. But basically, 50 Cent, you can't stop that sample in that mixtape because it's a copyright issue and you're not the copyright owner. Which brings us to this second case, which is a totally different case. But it's interesting that again, in essence, what the court was saying to the plaintiff in the case, which in this case was the lyrics site Genius, yeah, you're pursuing a copyright case over a copyright that you don't own. So definite parallel between these two cases, even though technically they're in very different areas of the law. So this was the Genius case, which I'm pretty sure we talked about at length on Setlist.
Yes, we've done an episode on this. I'll stick it in the show notes.
When this dispute first kicks off. So this is Genius's claim that Google, in its search engine, often puts lyrics in what it calls the info boxes. So what that means is if you search the name of a track or a song on the Google search engine, before you get any actual links to websites, for example, maybe the lyrics on the Genius site, you see the Google info box. And in the info box, there'll be various bits of information about the artist and the song. And these days, usually, there'll be lyrics there as well. And Google sources those lyrics either from the publishers of the songs or actually in many cases from the lyric aggregator Lyricfind. But Genius's allegation was, no, the lyrics that you have on your info box, those have been cut and pasted off our website.
Yeah, so Genius became suspicious that this was happening, that someone was, rather than sourcing lyrics themselves through legitimate means, they were just going on the Genius site, copying and pasting them onto Google's system, and then they were getting shown up. But obviously, that's annoying for Genius because it wants people to go to its website. It doesn't want people to just Google lyrics and have them displayed there for them to see. So in order to work out whether or not this was happening, Genius started putting a little code. It put different types of apostrophes in its lyrics that spelt out, I think, red-handed in Morse code is what it was. And then lo and behold, those coded apostrophes started showing up in Google's info boxes, meaning that indeed Google had been caught red-handed. And so Genius, well, it tried launching a PR campaign to embarrass Google when Google wasn't particularly embarrassed because, I mean, how, can you embarrass Google? I don't know. They decided to go legal. But as you said, the issue there is that while someone might have been copying and pasting text off Genius, while Genius has put that text into its site, the text is lyrics and Genius does not own those lyrics. It licenses them in the same way that Google would. So it did not own any copyright in this because as far as I know, you can't copyright apostrophes, even if they're coded. So in the same way that 50 Cent couldn't sue for copyright, Genius couldn't sue for copyright infringement either.
Yeah, because it wasn't the copyright owner, but it wanted to sue. So it got its
Who
lawyers...
Who doesn't love suing?
It got its lawyers...
I do.
...to look at the law and think, well, how could we sue? And the arguments they pursued was, first of all, that somebody somewhere, or maybe a scraping technology, was pulling content off the Genius website and that doing so was against the terms and conditions of the Genius website, which obviously everybody reads, and therefore Google, or somebody that Google was affiliated to, was in breach of contract. So there was a breach in contract element, and then there were some other state law claims. I think for things like unjust enrichment under New York state law, possibly Californian law as well. So those were the legal arguments that Genius presented when they finally went legal on this dispute. But the court dismissed the case, basically saying, as we've been saying throughout this section, this is a copyright case. What you're angry about here is copyright infringement, but you're not the copyright owner. So you've manufactured a state law case when really this case is about federal copyright law. So we're not going to accept all of your arguments. This can only be pursued as a copyright case, but you can't do that because you're not the copyright owner. There was the potential argument that by transcribing the lyrics, I don't know about the apostrophes thing, that would be odd, but could you say, well, somebody at Genius typed the lyrics in, and that's work, not really creativity, but it is, you know, creative work, I guess. Could you say, well, therefore there should be copyright in Genius's specific transcription of the lyrics, and therefore they get rewarded for their effort? Except that would make Genius's transcription of the lyrics a derivation of the original lyrics, and in order to do that, you would need permission from whoever owned the original copyright, and the publisher of the lyrics wouldn't have provided that specific permission to Genius. I mean, Genius has licensing deals with music publishers, but it wouldn't cover that specific use of the copyright work, so therefore they can't claim that. So yeah, the whole case fell through. So that was basically another copyright case which was pretending not to be a copyright case, but it was a copyright case. There wasn't a copyright owner, and so the court kicked it out. Again, like with 50 Cent, it remains to be seen if Genius tried to take that case further.
But obviously we don't know if that's happening yet. So that's it for this edition of Setlist. Do remember to subscribe, rate and review. Get the word out about the show to people who might be interested in it. Just like you, I presume, are. If you're listening now, you got this far, tell some people about it. If you've got any questions or comments about anything we've discussed in this episode of Setlist, you can email us, setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk. You can also read into everything we've discussed here today further by going to the show notes for this episode, which you'll either find in your podcast player, or you can go to setlistpodcast.com. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by Andy Moulton and Chris Cook. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Setlist is an Unlimited production.